Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Laurie Moore, whose latest book is a collection of stories, Bark. This is the seventh book by Laurie Moore. There are other collections, Self-Help, Birds of America. She's also the author of three novels, the latest of which is A Gate at the Stairs. I interviewed you for that, and at the time I remember thinking, wow, Laurie Moore is basically this amazing short story writer, but I'm going to be talking to her about a novel. Today I'll be able to talk to you about your short stories and also a little about the differences in writing novels and short stories. Let me start by asking, you have not had a collection in a while. These stories were written over how many years?
10 years. 10 years of stories, and I thought, well, that's enough. I'll just wrap them up and put them in a collection and move on. I mean, moving on is one of the big tricks of the writing life. It's often hard to do, but I really admire someone like Joyce Carol Oates who knows exactly how to do it, to move on.
Your stories and the way you write, every word is specifically there for a purpose, so it must be difficult to finally let it go. How easy is that, or how hard?
It's very hard to let things go, and just when you think you've got every word in place and, you know, you've put the story in a corner of your desk and you go to bed at night and then you wake up in the morning and look at it again, you see all kinds of mistakes and everything's wrong and you have to not start over completely, but you have to continue your fixing of things.
How do you know you're done?
You know you're done when you can see the mistakes and you just have accepted them completely in your heart and you can't fix them.
What is a mistake?
A mistake can be any number of things. It could be that you went a certain distance up the wrong road, but there's no turning back. A mistake in art is very similar to a mistake in life. You know, you can't get a time machine and go back. And I'm also very frugal. Because I'm a slow writer, I don't throw things away. So I just try to make the best of things. But at some point, you just say, this is as good as it can be. Now, you're mostly interested in the energies that you've put in play in a narrative, and you want them to conclude. You want them to spring out, be exhausted, and be done. And if there's still, you know, energies that need to be released or completed somehow, perhaps it needs more work.
And this is a different question from when a story ends in terms of the narrative, the last word of the story.
Yes and no, I suppose. There are certain things that can be out of chronology, but they're in an emotional sequence that is linear that you have devised on your own.
This one story, I believe, in Subject to Search, where the last section of the story takes place before the story itself.
Right. There are two stories, I think, that do that, or maybe even three. It's something that Alice Munro does all the time, and she's the queen of that, where she can find the very center and pivotal part of the story, and that's where she'll end. Subject to Search, I end because I wanted it finally. I mean, it's about a guy who's working in the intelligence world and the woman who is his friend and with whom there is a kind of romantic life between them. So I sort of wanted it to be a love story with an ambiguous character. But I wanted the ending to be about endings, and he does say, oh, we're all suckers for a happy ending. I did want that to be the ending of that story. But I also wanted that moment of physical and emotional connection, and I wanted that dialogue to be the concluding dialogue of the story.
I noticed in a lot of these stories, about halfway through, I'd be thinking, what's going to happen next, and where's it going to end? And then it occurs to me, it will end when it ends, and I may not have the conclusion I want. And that both upsets me and relaxes me at the same time.
Well, that's the beauty of a short story. It won't betray you too much, I think. With a novel, if you venture up the road of a novel for, you know, the length of time it takes both to write it, but even just to read it, you may feel betrayed by the ending. But a short story, there's always another short story next in line, so you can just move on to that.
two stories in the collection, Bark, Laurie Moore, two stories are much longer than the others, Wings and Debarking. When you're setting out to write a story, is that particular fact going to be there from the start, just as a novel you know is a novel?
A little bit. Debarking is about the length I thought it would be, maybe a little longer, but I was working with the length of time between Mardi Gras, which is usually in February, and I think in 2003 it was in February, and Easter weekend. And in that time, in 2003, the invasion of Iraq occurred. And so I had the chronological parameters in place. So I knew that I had to move that character and his life through all those days and weeks. With Wings, I actually thought it might be even longer. I thought it might be a true novella. And it maybe fell a little short of that and just became a long, short story.
And that happens when suddenly you go, this is it.
Yeah, I've gotten to the end.
Debarking is also a great story because it combines the story of this really fascinating, I mean, I couldn't take my eyes off of him, a character named Ira, who winds up dating a woman, let's say, with issues. And the background is the build up to the Iraq War of 2003. I guess this was written 2004 or something?
It was written in 2003 and published in The New Yorker in 2003. As someone said to me, you got to work very fast. I said, yep, I did.
How are these two elements related? Did you start with, I need to deal with what I've just been witnessing and I'm putting it in the background of the story, or how did that work?
Well, I wanted the story of Ira, but the Iraq thing was also happening, and I thought, well, this is how life is. You know, these two things can occur at the same time, and someone can be preoccupied both with what is going on in the country and also what is going on in their personal lives, and there's an intersection. It's not as if you can live separately from the world. And as we know, many, many people were extremely upset with the invasion of Iraq, and it was on their minds. And Ira is a character who is one of those. At the same time, he's living his life, which, you know, is pretty bumpy at this point. He's slightly obsessive, but, you know, he's basically a good guy.
You've said, and I guess it applies very much to Debarking, that a person has to be revealing something that isn't funny for the revelation of it to be funny. So that particular statement, what do you mean by they have to be revealing something that isn't funny so that we can laugh?
I assume what I mean, and this is what I would just say anyway about all humor, is that the context is everything, and that it's the context of something that gives the tension to what ends up being funny. That what's funny on its own probably isn't. Usually tension comes about from contradiction and forces and expectations that are somehow thwarted or headed, you know, for collision. And then something erupts or emerges. But the thing itself that ends up being the thing you laugh at, it's probably a revelation of vulnerability or a deflection or a failure to deflect or something that in and of itself isn't funny, but in the context, there's tension released and humor emerges. If you listen to how, I mean, I'm not an expert on humor, but I do try to listen to why and how something is funny in the real world when it is funny.
Sometimes do you find yourself writing something and then laughing and then going, oh, I did it? I mean, is that how that sometimes
well,
works?
Well, sometimes I will think something's funny, and then I have to recontextualize it. I mean, I think I have a proper context for how that's funny. But then when I go to put it in a story. It needs to be recontextualized again.
Dave Barry, who I talked to last year about writing humor, said that one issue is that humor on the printed page is very, very different than humor, say, in a theater or watching a movie or a stand-up comedian, that you laugh in a different way. It has to be a certain way.
I think it's harder. I assume it's harder because it's what I'm trying to do, so I assume everything I'm trying to do is harder than anything else. In theater, you have a couple of extra tools at hand. You know, you have not just the writing, you have the physical presence of the actor who is uttering things, and there's all kinds of things you could do with a straight line that suddenly makes it funny. There's intonation, there's responses of other people on stage who are, you know, there's blocking, there's lighting, there's all kinds of timing things. You can control the timing. With stuff on the page, it's all of, you only have the words on the page. You have nothing else. You can't control the timing. You can't control the tone of voice or anything. So it's harder.
Laurie Moore, one of your stories, Referential, you've said is kind of a rewrite of a story by Nabokov. Can you go into that a little bit?
Well, I don't know that I would call it a rewrite because that seems so dishonoring of the Nabokov story, which is a beautiful story called Signs and Symbols, which I had read a number of times and I had taught to my students. And I was reading it again. This was probably 2 years ago. And suddenly a kind of shadow story was born in my brain. And I may have been inspired a little bit by what Nathan Englander had done with the Ray Carver story, what we talk about when we talk about love, which had been inspired by the Chekhov story about love. And, of course, Englander wrote a story called What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. So that may have been in the back of my mind, but other things I think were as well. And I thought, what if you followed the story, the Nabokov story, and wrote something that was different but bounced off of it, bounced off the contours, actually used some of the language, dipped in to stitch itself to it so you weren't disguising it. You were deliberately referring to it. There is an idea in the Nabokov story called Referential Mania where this mentally ill boy feels everything refers to himself. And so I use that idea for in a way, all the characters and for the story itself, that it's a piece of its own referential mania. It's referring to the Nabokov story.
When I've spoken with artistic directors of local theater companies, they often talk about, when putting together a season, how one play will talk to another play within the context of the season. The difference, though, is that if you're working in a season, let us say, then seeing multiple plays will force the conversation. In this case, the conversation is almost one-sided unless you know about the other story.
So I created a shadow story that had to sort of work on its own, but it also, I assumed that the Nabokov story was famous enough. Maybe I was wrong. I also thought, well, maybe one isn't even allowed to do this. You know, maybe one shouldn't, maybe one isn't allowed. I did a lot of different things to make it different, and then I did a lot of similar things to make it similar, and I just decided to do what I did. And then I turned it into the New Yorker, and I said, is this allowed? Can I do this? They don't do the fussy thing of, you know, after Nabokov, but I did add that to the book so that people would know.
And Wings has a reference, of course, to Wings of a Dove, so you're doing it again there.
Right. Well, that doesn't follow the story so closely. It just kind of lifts a plot element that has been lifted before. Terrence Malick did it in Days of Heaven, and other people have lifted James's plots, including James himself. He was always using the same triangle and twisting it around and going at it from a different angle. So I took a plot element and then just reset it in a completely different context.
when you're starting those kinds of stories, I mean, the case of the of referential, obviously it was the Nabokov that put you in there. But when you're looking at something like Wings, was that always in your mind? Or did you suddenly see as you were writing that, oh, wait a second, I know this?
I think I was very interested in the idea of two attractive young people who didn't have money themselves plotting against someone who did. It's a kind of Gilded Age story, and we're in a new Gilded Age. And so I think I began with that, and I knew that was Wings of the Dove in a general sense. And so it's only Wings of the Dove in the general sense. But just in case people didn't notice, I threw in all these James references, like Wings and an epigraph and calling one of the characters Casey and the other one Dench. And, you know, I had a lot of arrows pointing.
At the same time, you're also, I guess, saying to the audience, get a good laugh out of that if you want to.
I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't have bothered. I you know, my last novel, I thought I was sprinkling it through with all these Jane Eyre references. And, of course, very few people even noticed it. And a writer friend of mine said, you're crazy to think anyone would have noticed that. I said, really? I thought it was just so obvious, but whatever.
You're listening to an interview with Laurie Moore, whose latest collection is titled Bark. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. Obviously, we're talking about titles, referential, Wings. How important is a title to a story? And for the reader of your stories, Laurie Moore, how important should that title be? Should they be able to make a connection all the time? Should that be a key element for them? For some people, it's not.
It can be. It's sometimes more important in some stories than others. You know, in referential, the very next word is mania, so it's important to read the title and go to the next word, referential mania. But in Wings, that may not be a terribly important title, although it refers to several things in the story. I sometimes tell my students, I say, you have three opportunities to succinctly thematize your story, so don't be redundant. Don't have the same words in your title, in your first sentence, or in your last sentence. They should all be different, because those are different opportunities to underscore or heighten an important image or theme or idea, and they should all be different. They shouldn't repeat themselves.
I've talked to a number of writers and asked them about the themes of the stories, and what I get most of the time, not all the time, what I get most of the time from novelists is that the theme is something for, say, me to figure out rather than for something for them to focus on. For you, Laurie Moore, in a short story, as opposed to maybe in a novel, where does the theme come in? Afterward, before, during the writing?
Maybe during, certainly after, but you begin with the people. I mean, because themes are easy in a way, but you always begin with the people, the characters. If you're not interested in the characters, you're in the wrong line of work. But you begin with them, and you begin with feelings and circumstances that they would be in, and you're working all of that. And themes will drop in, and certain images will suddenly emerge, and you have to place a kind of design on it by the, you know, second, third, fourth draft.
At a certain point, do you ever see, say, as I said before, that sometimes a play will talk to another play, that one story of yours written around the same time will, in a way, talk with another story?
I don't feel I've ever had that experience, but I feel they're very independent, but perhaps they aren't. Perhaps they're having a conversation I don't know about, but I never, if they're whispering among themselves, talking in the back of the room. But, I mean, I know that happens with writers. The most famous instance of that is, I guess, probably Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream and Romeo and Juliet, which were written the same year, and scholars argue which was written first, but each is buried in the other. You know, they are having a conversation, and one is a tragedy, one's a comedy. They each have elements of tragedy and comedy in them, but they're having a very elaborate conversation with each other. But I don't really feel that, although I have two Ians in this book, which I didn't realize until I was proofing the galleys.
Well, Well, that raises another question. You said in one interview that you start with the characters and they're usually nameless and then they find names. How does that happen? Or do they start with names? Did Ira start with a name?
You know, Ira, which is a word so close to Iraq, was something I didn't notice until I was well underway. So I did not design that. And then after I noticed that, I thought, that's too close, that's not good. But I was already too wedded to him as being an Ira.
But some of the other names, I mean, obviously Dench and KC, but say Kit and Rafe in one story, Robin Ross in another, Tom as the CIA agent. How did those names emerge? Just like, oh, this is a Tom?
No, I had trouble with that, with Tom, because he really was a Sam. But I have another Sam and another story. See, that this is the problem with a collection of short stories. You have so many people to name. A novel, you have fewer people to name. But a short story, you have a lot of people to name. So that name was I struggled with. And, of course, writers love monosyllabic names. The rhythm is easier to work with. And so Nick is a great, you know, but Hemingway got there with Nick and Jake, and, you know, those are the great male names.
That brings up a question, rhythm. How does rhythm play a role in your stories? And how do you achieve rhythm, which, of course, may be the secret to Laurie Moore, so maybe you don't want to give away a state secret, but how does rhythm play into the way we view a story? I assume it comes later as you're polishing.
I think it comes right away.
Really?
As you're trying to find the story's voice, and as you write each sentence, you're writing it to your own ear, and you have to trust your ear. So there's a rhythm aspect to it. Now, you can correct the rhythm and improve the rhythm in subsequent drafts, and you can also wreck it by tinkering too much and then wrecking the rhythm and having to recorrect it. And we're talking about rhythm, which is a sort of ineffable thing, and it's something in your mind's ear that you're writing toward. I think you're also hoping that the reader is hearing things in the same way you are, that shares that same rhythmic thing. And beyond that, I really don't have very many precise terms for that, but it's a very important concept, and writers talk about it all the time. They're talking about, you know, the importance of it and getting it, but the actual defining and what it is and where it comes from is much harder.
How about choosing first person versus third person?
That's a craft question that is a very important one, and you have to get that right, and sometimes you don't. Many, many writers begin stories, sometimes novels, they're up, you know, 100 pages up the road, and they're in the third person, and then they think, no, this should be in the first, or vice versa. If you're going to have several points of view, probably third person is better. Some people think that the first person is more intimate. That's not really true. But the first person will be a character. You know, if you're in the first person, it's a character. The voice, every sentence is a piece of characterization. With the third person, less so. But I think the third person is the most limber. Third person past tense. You know, Updike's rabbit novels, for instance, are third-person present tense, which is a very unusual, I think it's an unusual thing in literature generally, but for a great American novel, if you want to call all those rabbit novels a single novel, that's an unusual point of view to be writing it.
Laurie Moore, I've noticed more present tense books being written now than used to be written. I remember it used to strike me when I saw present tense, and now I kind of go, oh, another present tense novel.
People used to complain about that in the 80s. I haven't noticed that that's true, but the 80s is already like 30 years ago, so people were complaining about it 30 years ago. What is all this present tense? And sometimes Gordon Lish at Knopf got blamed for it, and sometimes Raymond Carver, who was Lish's writer, was blamed for it. I try to discourage it a little bit in my students. I don't see a whole lot of it, but sometimes when I do, I have to say, you have to understand that the present tense is a tense of trappedness, and you're stripping your narrative of a perspective that you can get if you write in the past tense. You're stripping the narrative of a layer of intelligence, and you're writing in a tense of paralysis. And that's what the present tense is for. It's not for immediacy. They think it's all about, it's more immediate. It's not. It's about being trapped. Which is why the Updike novels are interesting that way. Because they're about a guy who's trapped.
What I saw recently is using a second person, you, which I guess is kind of this strange narrative device, and I'm not sure why that would work or not work.
The second person is something poets have used for a very, very long time. I used a version of it, a mock imperative second person, in my very first book of stories in the 80s, again in the 80s. Jay McInerney's very famous book, Bright Lights, Big City, was in the second person. So it was being done. It was being done more by poets, but fiction writers who were interested in language and interested in the directness of that address. And also, I was interested in what happens when you put the verb right at the front of the sentence. I seldom had you. It was mostly in the mock imperative. So I would say, you know, understand that your cat is a whore. You know, that's the beginning of one of my stories. You know, I was in my 20s, but I thought, that is a radical thing. And the verb is right at the start. There's, you know. And so I was having fun with that. But I don't do that anymore. But some people do. Juno Diaz is writing a lot of things in the second person, but we both went to Cornell, so maybe it has something to do with Ithaca, New York.
When you look at your career and you see those kinds of changes in your own writing, is there anything that strikes you as a transformation or any transformative moment in getting from the Laurie Moore of, say, 30 years ago to the Laurie Moore of today?
No, I really haven't studied myself that way. And I really wouldn't want to. All I do know is that I have no interest in writing in the second person ever again, and that perhaps I am more comfortable in the third person than I was initially, but I got to the third person pretty quickly. One thing I have not done is written a novel in the third person, so I have noticed that.
In a way, I guess, maybe I'm wrong, but in a way, writing in the first person immediately gives you
a character
and a focus.
Right. And it gives you some latitude. So if you have the narrator sort of wandering off into a meditative state, it's not the novel doing that, it's the character. And you can say, so it at least when I was using it for the novels I used it for, I felt it had more forgiveness in it.
It also has more unreliability.
Yes, it does. And sometimes you have to find ways of getting the story past that first-person narrator.
That will happen, I would guess, if you suddenly go, well, you know, the reader needs to know something, and the character doesn't know it.
Right.
How am I going to do that?
You have to get other people talking. And even though the narrator's right there in the room and on the page, the narrator may not get it. I mean, Ford Madox Ford probably has the most famous example of that.
I guess when you begin to break apart a story like that, it becomes almost a series of jigsaw puzzles, that you're trying to solve a puzzle and then another puzzle and then another puzzle. And this is even beyond dealing with voice or language.
You're right. A novel especially because the longer the narrative goes on, the more knots and tangles and corners you've painted yourself into that you suddenly have to get out of. And it is a puzzle. And sometimes every writer will tell you this. You go to bed at night and you think, this is unsolvable. I don't really know how I'm going to solve this. And sometimes you wake up in the morning and your dream mind has solved the problem. You wake up, I know, I'll do this. And I'll have them do this and this, you know, or it comes to you in the shower or something. It comes to you on a train.
How often do you reach a point where it doesn't come? And then what do? Just toss it?
I refuse to toss. You know, I'm just too frugal. You can maybe make a botch of the fixing. You do your best. Sometimes your best bet maybe is deleting the part that isn't working. If you really have tried and tried and tried, can't make it work, maybe it's got to come out. Tossing the whole thing away, I would never do.
God, that sounds like me editing an interview. No, I mean, we reach a point in an interview where something is just like, it slows it down, it stops it. And then I go, well, you know, it's kind of interesting, but what if I just clip this 30 seconds? And I clip the 30 seconds and suddenly it flows.
Right, right. Editing is key in all things.
Lori Moore, I know that you love plays. You said, I love plays, even bad ones, in an interview. Have you thought about writing? Have you written plays?
You know, a director approached me a year or two ago and said, you know, are you interested in writing plays? And he's a wonderful director. But I said, I am. At any rate, I ended up trying to adapt a story to the stage, and then it wasn't enough. And then I thought, well, if you put another story in here. And so I said to him, look, here's an adaptation of this story. And if you paired it with an adaptation of Jhumpa Lahiri's story over here, because there was a Jhumpa Lahiri story I saw, I could see that it would make a wonderful play. Then you'd have two short stories adapted to the stage, and it would go on for an hour and 15 minutes. I don't know that anyone really wants to see that. That's my adventure in theater.
Actually, I saw that. Someone adapted two Chekhov stories and did that exactly that at Berkeley Rep earlier this year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And it worked out all right?
Yeah, sure.
You know, I did have a story that was done by Word for Word Theater, which is a brilliant ensemble, a brilliant company, and I just laughed my head off. They did things with it that I just never would have predicted, and they did the story word for word, and I just had a ball watching it. So that's partly what made me think, well, maybe I could adapt something, but I don't know. I don't think I'm going to do that.
In a couple of these stories, particularly Foes, I think the name of it is,
mm-hmm.
and in Debarking, there's political context in the background, mm-hmm. and also, I guess, in Subject to Search. But it stays in the background. You have no interest in bringing it to the foreground, I guess.
Well, it depends what you call foreground and what you call background. I think Debarking is about the madness of the world and the different forms madness takes. And at the end, he is in a bar alone. He's given up on this relationship. He's been driven mad less by dating, I think, than by the prospect of this war. And he has this speech that he gives at the end in a bar. And somebody says, smack that guy. And Foes is about that very exciting year, 2009, when Obama was running for president. It was all very exciting and thrilling, but some people may have gotten carried away in their minds. I might have been one of them. And then Subject to Search is more direct in that this is a guy who really is doing intelligence work for a living, as many people actually do. I've known a couple.
The final story in the book, Thank You for Having Me, is actually one of my favorites because In the middle of this strange wedding, a motorcycle gang drives up.
That story is sort of my farewell story to Wisconsin, and so I was thinking, well, what would really happen at a June wedding at a Wisconsin farm? And there would be motorcycles going by. And so I started to do that, have the motorcyclists go by, and of course they would be on Harleys, because that's Wisconsin is the home of the Harley. Then I suddenly had the whole gang just kind of dropping in at the wedding. And, of course, they're at the wrong wedding.
Lori Moore, you have several characters who are failed musicians. And you tried to get a career going in music at one time?
No. I probably only fantasized about that when I was 11. But, no, I've known musicians. It's a hard life. I love music. I would love to have been a successful musician. I would have loved to even have been a failed musician, but I was somebody who played the piano quietly at home with no one listening.
But so many characters are failed musicians, people having difficulty of it. There's a pattern there.
Well, I love to spend time with them. I don't know. I'm sympathetic with them. I think, oh, this will be an opportunity to learn about this instrument or that world or something. For my last novel, the protagonist was a bass player. And I didn't really know much about bass playing, but my niece played the bass, and a friend in Madison played the bass, and so I would get information from them a little bit. And I also listened a lot to Edgar Meyer, the great classical bassist. And I've just learned that he lives in Nashville. And just the other day, I was sitting next to his wife. And I said, oh, my God, I spent a year researching your husband and listening to all the CDs. I didn't know they lived in Nashville.
Do you do any research for short stories?
Little kinds of research, sure.
But not like you would for a novel, where you have to really get into it.
A novel just, you know, is over a longer period of time, so you do more of the little kinds of research. I do a lot of little research rather than intense a year of only research, no writing. I couldn't do that. Someone I know is writing a biography, and he was told to write the biography first and do the research after.
Well, I know a lot of writers who will start work on something and then realize, oh, I have to do research. And at that point, they know what they're looking for.
Right.
And along the way, they're going to serendipitously find things that they could use, ways to get over that hump.
Right, right. And you can find yourself going off in other interesting tangents. I mean, that's fun. That's the fun part of both writing and researching.
Laurie Moore, you said in a 2004 interview, I recall a movie called My Pal Wolf. Some days I feel that all my work has come out of that one movie.
Oh, so silly.
Okay, we'll pass.
Well, no, we could. I'll humor you. And I did find someone who knew that. Do you know that film?
No, I don't.
I thought it was about a police dog, but I was corrected. It's about a little girl who finds a dog, and she thinks it's a wolf. And what it turns out to be is a military bomb-sniffing dog. This is during World War II. And he has to be taken back by the military police and taken back to the base. It's a knife in my heart just thinking about it.
And on some level, that knife in the heart goes to the core of a lot of Laurie Moore's stories.
Right. That the creature you think is a beautiful wolf turns out to be a military dog who's going to be taken away and blown to shreds by bombs. Yes. There it is. It has a certain beauty in it.
Laurie Moore, the title Bark. Why?
The bark of a tree, the animal cry of people and animals, the bark of Dante that carries the dead across the river Styx.
Where did you come up with it? At what point did you realize it was the title?
It's like Nick and Jake naming your cat. You know, I love these Anglo-Saxon words that end with K. And I did notice it in a number of my stories. So I thought, rather than title the book one of the titles of the stories, which places a lot of pressure, it's a burden on a story to be the title story, I thought that I would just call it Bark and, you know, it also has a papery feel, and that's, you know, it's a book of stories written on paper.
And the first story is also called Debarking.
That's right. It's about taking the bark away, taking the bark out of your voice and taking the bark off your skin.
Laurie Moore, now you've published this collection. I would assume that there are stories out there which have not been published then?
You would hope. I've been busy. I've moved from Madison to Nashville. You want to hear all my excuses? I don't have a lot of stories that have not been published, no. And in fact, I may be working on a novel next. I mean, I am starting a novel and maybe some stories too.
Can you do both at the same time?
Well, I have to some extent. I'm a very slow writer, so if a novel takes 5 years or 10 years, you know, if I get an idea for a story, I will write it so that it doesn't evaporate and go away during that time. So these stories were written from 2003 to 2013, And I was also working on A Gate at the Stairs, which came out in 2009.
Well, when you're doing that, when you're putting a novel aside like that, is it easy to just go back and pick up on it after you've published the story or written the story?
Yeah, it actually is. If the novel's going well, it is.
And if it's not going well?
Well, I haven't gotten to that point yet. I mean, it always feels like there's a strong voice and a character there waiting for you. And maybe that's why I've written in the first person, you know, for novels. Because you can pick up that voice, you can run with it, you feel the narrator is just there, like a genie in a bottle, you know.
You've been listening to an interview with Laurie Moore, whose latest collection of short stories is called Bark. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.